Top 100 Clubhouse podcast is brought to you by Eden Mill, bringing the tradition of distilling whiskey and gin back to St. Andrews, the home of golf.
This is golf architect Tyler Ray. You know, I guess your listeners will know us from, you know, Donald Ross golf courses and a lot of historical restorations in America. And now, fortunately, a bunch of new builds that that we're putting together.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Top 100 Clubhouse, the ultimate podcast for golf course enthusiasts worldwide. I'm your host, James Henderson, and we're about to embark on a journey through lush fairways and breathtaking landscapes, as well as delving deep into the minds of fascinating individuals from every corner of the golfing universe. Get ready to explore the world's top golf courses through the eyes of those who know them best. Let's start with the same question I will start with. Tyler, what gave you the bug in golf and how did you get into it?
Yeah, great question, James. You know, probably both grandfathers, you know, they were avid golfers, played multiple times a week. So both from age four onward, you know, were putting clubs in my hand. My father as well, he'd sneak out many, many afternoons and kind of bring me along with him. So all the males in my family pretty much were all diehard golfers and loved the game, talked about golf all day, every day. We watched tournaments on the weekends, amateur, professional, all the majors. You know, we would have big family dinners for, you know, this Sunday of Augusta and this Sunday of the U.S. Open, things of that nature. So golf always was very big in my life from a young guy, you know, from age four, five, six onward. And then I really got into junior golf from about 9 or 10 or 11 onward. And my parents would drop me off at the golf course on their way to work and pick me up at dark. And I kind of just lived, you know, I was just like a golf lifer, golf junkie, you know, at the course. Everybody, you kind of meet everybody, you know everybody. And these were just public golf courses growing up in Delaware, just south.
Which golf courses were there?
You know, I was playing at Delcastle Golf Club, which is in Wilmington, Delaware, which is a public course. And then Heartfelt National was a private course that my grandfather was a member at from like 1995 onward, 94, 95 onward. And then Deerfield Golf and Tennis was another private club that I joined probably about 17. So I started public golf from probably 8 or 9 or 10 onward to about 15. And then when I was 15, my grandfather joined a private course. And so then we played there. And then about 16 or 17, I joined another private club with a bunch of other juniors, a bunch of other friends. And consequently, we had guys that played at Duke, Maryland, UCF, a bunch of really high quality college golfers that Deerfield Golf and Tennis put out. They had a great pro named Dale Laceline, who is still a friend to this day. And he had a great junior program. So we had like 12 guys at a one or better I was about 18. So our junior club championship was almost better than the men's club championship. So we had a
junior events.
Oh, it was the best. And so I look back on those days very fondly. And that's really, I mean, we were just golf diehards, golf junkies, and really into it. And I loved seeing the architecture playing junior golf in Philadelphia. So we would be invited to play Marion and Arana Mink and just some of these classic golf courses that you see on all the top 100 lists, you know, on your lists, James.
It's not a bad place to be going to play golf.
Right. So we were fortunate to get some of those invites and we really, you know, for me, other golfers, I think, just enjoyed it, but I really absorbed, you know, wow, look at the contour in these greens. Wow, look at this layout. you know, look at this beautiful clubhouse, you know, at Marion or Aronimink or Huntington Valley. And I just loved every single day going to a different course. I really enjoyed from a young guy, you know, from a young age, being invited by friends or playing in little tournaments, you know, just little get-togethers at different courses. I couldn't wait to go see a new golf course I had never seen before. I mean, like, I don't know what it was, the mysterious nature of that, you know, the unknown. Still loved, obviously, playing where we were playing, but yeah, I think that's what struck me. And then that's what got me into architecture was the varied playing fields, I think. Still to this day, I can't wait to go see a new course all the time.
Was it a conscious decision that built over time, or was it a moment in golf that you were like, right, I need to get in those dozers. I need to get on the maps. I need to see these things from behind the scenes.
I think, you know, the day I turned 14, my father had me working at DuPont Country Club. So this is another club. I mean, there's probably 6 or 7 clubs within 6 or 7 miles of our house. And I kind of played at all of them and then worked at all of them consequently from, you know, age 10 to 18 when I went to college and, you know, or uni. So I then, 14, the day I turned 14 and I guess in 98, I went to, DuPont Country Club and worked there, and they had the LPGA. They had a major tournament for the women every year, the McDonald's LPGA Classic, which was one of their 4 majors. So I got to see how that was maintained and work there for a couple years. But working there gave me free playing privileges, so I got to play there as well. So
good course.
Yeah, pretty good course. Pretty good old school, you know, from the early 20s. I think 1920 on the dot, I think, was when it was built. And just very classic straight away, perch greens, little Ross, kind of Ross perch greens. He laid out the course, Donald Ross did. So that was probably my first introduction to Donald Ross, you know, at 15. And
before we move on to Donald Ross, I do have a question. You said McDonald's there. Someone told me yesterday, the number of golf courses in America, which you'll know is 15,500 or something, around about there. Do you know how many McDonald's there are?
Not a clue.
13,500. So there's 2,000 more golf courses than McDonald's, which is really cool, right? So America loves golf more than McDonald's.
Yeah. Thank gosh. Yeah. I know we got up to, I thought, about 18,000 at one point, and I know we've closed, you know, from 1990 something onward, we've closed a bunch of courses, and then, you know, some courses sell off because the land is so expensive and they end up developing it for houses and that nature. But I thought we were up to like 18,800 at one point.
Wow.
And then we've trundled back.
I spoke to an architect, I think it was Curtis Bowman. And he was, yeah, it was him. And he was talking about the number of how difficult it was for him to get a job because the number of golf courses closing.
Yes.
Did you find that when you were coming up through the ranks that jobs were few and far between, or was it an easier ride from you because you started working with the right people early? Why not try Eden Mills, The Guard Bridge, blended malt whiskey or golf gin? Visit our sponsor's site, www.edenmill.com, for more information. Eden Mills St. Andrews, bringing the art of distilling back to St. Andrews.
I kind of targeted 5 or 6 really, really talented firms that I loved, and those were Bill Corin and Ben Crenshaw, and then Gil Hance and Tom Doak and Keith Foster and Ron Pritchard. And I maybe wrote to 1 or 2 others, but those five or six, you know, I wrote letters to and all responded. They were all great, but this was probably 2004. And so they were all really busy still at that time. Our bubble in America was like, 08, 9, 10, 11. And then by about 2012, it came back. And then 13, 14, 15, it was great after that. But I started my company in May May 5th of 2009, which is about the worst timing ever. And I remember Keith Foster sitting in his office and he said, Tyler, this is brilliant. It's a great idea. I think you got to go headfirst into it. And he said, I think it's the best time ever to start a company. And I kind of looked at him and I said, well, I have no idea if he's being facetious. Is he pulling my chain? And he gave it a great rationale. He said, Tyler, think about it this way. There's all these other guys in this industry that have families and they have all these commitments and they have all this stuff tied up. And they have to make $100,000 a year or more to keep their firm going, or maybe they have employees. And he said, look, you have no employees. You're not married yet. You don't have any kids. You really don't have anything to support. So if you make $40,000, who cares? You know, and you can stay in the business. And he said, you slowly will build your business. And then by the time everything turns around, everything's cyclical. He said, by the time things turn around, there will probably be about 50% less golf architects in the field. And then there'll be so much less competition and you'll be right there ready to go, ready to pounce. And he couldn't be more correct, which was, wild for him to predict. And so by the time I really got my feet under me and we were really cooking by, 2016, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, golf was back. And then, when the COVID when the pandemic kind of hit in 20, and then golf kind of flipped on its head. And then from 2021 onward, now we're right there. I guess, I don't know. I don't like any rankings or that sort, but we're fortunate to be maybe, a top 10 firm that people call, one of the top 10 or 20 or 30 guys that people, we're on their radar. So we're just happy to be on their radar. And in the
what mix. Do you which I've always described a golf course architect's calling card as their as the work they've done. It doesn't matter how good they are at chat, it's what they've redesigned. It's very difficult. It's like a business card to them. Is you say, have you been here? Because I did this, which is very cool the concept. But what do you think's your pride? Your pride and joy, your calling card that you say, right, this was, I'm very proud of this.
Well, probably our first really good one was still under the umbrella of Ron Pritchard. And that was 2016. We did Portland Country Club in Maine. And that's a beautiful Donald Ross right on the Atlantic Ocean. And I kind of went there and lived there and shaped every bunker, every tee, every green. And, it was a full-fledged restoration. And I felt like that came out really well. And so our people started talking a lot in the Northeast of America, and the Donald Ross Society visited and they said, wow, okay, this is really cool. We like this a lot. This is maybe some of our favorite stuff we've seen. And so everybody started chatting around Boston and I started getting some calls, from the Northeast. And then in 2019, we did Beverly Country Club in Chicago. And that was like a firestorm where everyone then in Chicago started calling, and that was a really big boon for us in the Midwest. And that was my last job with Ron Pritchard, where he really gave me free rein. He was still the architect of record, but he really let me, kind of be bold and I tried to honor a lot of what he was wanting out there as well, but he gave me a lot of carte blanche. So it was a big blend of our two theories. And that probably was the most successful thing that we put out. And it was good for him to go out on that high note, as he slowed down in his business. But that was me kind of putting out my final shingle. And so that one still to this day, it's like top five in Illinois now. And it's, it jumped all the way up to 51 in the Golf Week Golden Age, like classic ranking. So it went from like 300 and something to 51. So that was like the major, okay, all the publications, everybody saw that. So we really enjoyed that. And then, obviously lately it's been, we've been working at, a bunch of older classic courses and then building a new, a bunch of new new builds from scratch. But, you know, Wakanda Club, we're really excited. It's reopening here shortly, and we're hopeful that wins Restoration of the Year in Golf Digest. Lookout Mountain did win Restoration of the Year. Wampanoag, you know, there were 58 projects last year that they voted on, and that was number four. So we had the number one and the number four in America, you know, out of the top 58 or 58 projects that were worked on. So we thought that was, you know, we felt like, hey, not only did we have number one, but we also had the number four. So it, I thought that was more credibility because those were two projects we touched last year.
I've just come back from Lookout Mountain, and I was really blown away by the work you've done there. It's fantastic. I would just like to shout out to Trey Moon to say thank you for taking me. Mm-hmm. I loved it. Everything about it, just I wanted to play again. You know, it's mm-hmm. you did a really good job there. It was just
super bold.
Yeah, very bold, but fun.
Yeah,
it was a really enjoyable place.
That's what we were going for. You know, I saw what Gil Hance did at Piping, or well, not Piping Rock. It was at Sleepy Hollow. And I thought that was super bold and cool. And, you know, he put back the old horseshoe in the 16th green there. And I mean, you know, I just thought it was so cool. And like history and antiquity was oozing out of the property and out of his work. And I felt like that's what we tried to do and make it look like you were stepping back in time, you know, to 1925.
And, there's one of the questions I do have about that renovation was, the Baritz. Was it never a full Baritz? It was just a landing zone Baritz, because I know you didn't bring the green in. It was I don't know how to describe it properly.
Yeah, typical Baritz is like 155 feet long, you know, 50 yards long, and half a football field, half a soccer pitch, and his drawing, we were fortunate to have Rayner's personal drawing right before he died. So he drew it in October 25, and then he died in January 26. So we had his full routing, every bunker drawing, location, every green size, shape, everything. So from tee to green, his whole layout, which was beautiful. And so we faithfully tried to restore that. But on his Baritz, he only drew the back, you know, plateau as green. And then he had the valley going through as fairway height. And then obviously the front plateau as fairway height. And the only reason we think so is because it was all ledge rock as the first plateau. And so it always burns out. It's always rock hard, no pun intended. So you can land it on that first plateau and it'll hit really hard and then run up and scamper onto the back plateau. So for us, we would have had to blast the rock out to have fine turf and putting surface turf on the front. And so that was one reason we were like, well, this is going to be really expensive. And then two, it's like, well, Rayner never intended it to be because look at what he drew. So we tend to... You know, a lot of people use aerials. Like I know Gil Hance is very heavy on aerials and he wants to see what was built. And then he kind of puts back a lot of times what was built by that team. But I like to use sometimes more of the plans because that's what the architect drew, you know, and that's what they wanted. And so we had what Rayner wanted, because sometimes what happens is if there's not enough money or if they run into some problems or if there's a spring, you know, in the ground that they run into, things don't get built to what the architect's vision is. And so I feel like if money, you know, like at Lookout Mountain, we had the plan, luckily. So we put back the plan as if money weren't an object. Well, really money was a big problem then. And they were running out of money because they ran into so much ledge rock and granite that it really only got built like halfway. And so if we used an aerial, we would have put it back halfway. And so for us, we were like, why don't we make this phenomenal? It'll help the club for the next 100 years and it'll get a lot of attention and it'll be a faithful restoration to Rayner's plans. Because if you look at Rayner's work, you know, if he worked on like 55 to 60 courses that we know about, we know he worked on way more, but there's about 55 or 60 that are sitting there in the flesh that are around. You know, there's like 10 that have plans, maybe 7 to 8 that have physical drawings from him. So how rare is that?
How did you feel when you found it? You must have.
We were like, this is the key to success. This is the roadmap. We loved it. I mean, it made our jobs, no offense, it made our jobs easier because it makes the decisions easier because we knew where he wanted things and the green shapes and the sizes and all that.
So. It was never going to be easy though, because the location of that ground that he's built on is what must have been one of the most ambitious projects back then.
Mm-hmm. And that's why they ran out of money, because it was so ambitious. They were building a hotel down in Florida at that time, and then they were building a huge hotel on that mountain, 1,800 feet up in the air, overlooking Chattanooga. And a hurricane hit the hotel in Florida and flattened that. And then they had all sorts of issues, you know, at Lookout Mountain with, you know, rock. And right after they seeded the course and sprigged the course and put this topsoil everywhere. And then they got like a 7-inch rainstorm that washed all the topsoil off the mountain.
Oh my God.
So they had like issue after issue after issue. And so it never really was really built and finished.
One of the cool sites that I think I've got a photo of it somewhere is you've moved the green on 14. And you can see the hand dug drainage ditch for the old green in the stone below. I was blown away by that. And it showed you they didn't have the dynamite to get rid of the rock up there. And it was fascinating to see.
Yeah, I love that. We did a lot of definitely some funky stuff on that job. We left a lot of exposed rock in bunkers too, which is very rare. Because it's like, if you have a tournament there, what do? And so it has to be a local rule. If your ball comes to rest against the granite in the bunker. So things of that nature. And yeah, a lot of exposed rock. And then the views, you can see 7 states from that property, which is, I don't know how that's possible.
You know? That's a lot of states.
Yeah.
It's probably... It's up there with the best vistas I've ever seen on a golf course. Mm-hmm. It is really quite spectacular. Once you go past it, finish the second and go out onto that rock, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Right. One thing I would love to ask you right now that I was going to ask you earlier, but I just got on to Lookout because I loved it, was you've worked with almost anyone, all the names in architecture. What things have you taken away from each one that you think they have taught you, or you think they're the best at, so you've learned from them and taken that forward with your own career?
Oh, that's a good one, James. Yeah, that's a deep one for sure. You always see when you're working for gentlemen and working for firms, you can see pretty much right away what their strengths are and what their weaknesses are. I think, you know, working for Bill and Ben, you know, Bill Core and Ben Crenshaw, they obviously were so good in the field. And watching Bill Core, like I just built 2 greens this week down in South Carolina. There are 2 27-hole properties that we're building in South Carolina. And so that's 54 greens just with those 2 this year, obviously. And so I built 4, 8. I think 10 at the 1 already, but we're building about a green or 2 a week, and we're spending so much time, you know, building these greens and then working backwards a little bit on the golf holes. But, you know, I personally shape all my greens, and I have forever in my whole career. And I love it so much because it's so intricate. There's so much detail. But watching Bill Core at Dormy Club in Pinehurst, when we were building that in 2006 to 2008, watching Bill, he would sit on the Sand Pro and they would move a little bit here and he would get this. And I mean, he was just a master of, spent so much time on the Sand Pro, just really refining and getting the best, every little square inch of that green, you know, that putting surface, whether it be 7,000 square feet or 10,000 square feet. I mean, he was massaging everything. And I remember.
Sorry, just for listeners, the Sand Pro. Can you describe it to them just so they can?
Sure. Saint Pro is a little three-wheeled machine that you put usually in bunkers, and it smooths out the bunker sand before you play the round. So the maintenance department usually use, you know, the grounds crew usually uses them. And this is, usually in America, maybe, you know, your bunkers might be smaller, you know, little pop bunkers, you know, over in the UK. So usually they don't need a sand pro. These are for bigger bunkers where you can turn around and smooth the sand out, and it just saves on labor. So we use sand pros when we finish golf courses for fairways, tees, and greens, because it smooths out the sand and gets a beautiful seed bed for us to seed or sprig or lay sod on. So we finish greens, you know, we build greens with bulldozers, bigger 8 foot, 10 foot blades, you know, bigger machines, 18,000 pound, you know, 25,000 pound machines. And so we get all the major contours and nuances, and we get the compaction right, so it doesn't settle. But then we finish them with hand rakes and sand pros. And so I was on a sand pro, and my team, the guys working with me, some of my crew members, I mean, we're just massaging and working these greens. But where I was going with that is watching Bill Kaur beat it into my head and really hit me and stayed with me, you know, that to build the best greens, you have to really spend a lot of time on those little delicate internal contours and a little flutter here and a little valley working out of the green here and a little bump. Like this week, we were working on two bumps at the back of the green, so the horizon line wasn't flat and bland and insipid. We just stood on the front of the green and I was like, you know, we have all this stuff going on the green. It's not too crazy. It's very gentle. There's plenty of flagstick locations, but I just want to add a little bump middle back right and then one back left, just to give the horizon line a little flavor and a little flutter, just so it's just elegant from the fairway. Yep. And so we worked on that, you know, from Sunday to last night at dark on Thursday night. So not just those two little parts, but the two greens we were working on. And so for Bill Corn Crenshaw, that was, you know, just how much time they spend and how great they were in the field. And it shows with how many phenomenal golf courses they've put out in their career. And then, you know, probably on Doak's team, I worked under Bruce Heppner for Renaissance Golf when I did Cape Arundel Golf Club. It's an old Walter Travis in Maine, just south of Portland, Maine. It's like, I want to say a 1925 Walter Travis, 1926. Maybe earlier, about that time frame. But it has some of the best greens in America, like mini Augusta greens. So they're known for these buried little elephants. And it's literally like Augusta National. You know, Augusta's greens are huge. So it's the same type of stuff, but just smaller. So every green has so much stuff going on. And James, I'm talking like big 4 foot rolls and literally buried elephants. And so this thing opened up my eyes, and working with Bruce Heppner there, I got to see what he was thinking about with bunkers and this and that, and and their thoughts and how they were trying to fit things into landforms, and that really resonated with me with Doak and that guy, you know, and Heppner and their crew. Was they were constantly trying to fit things in like a glove. I remember shaping bunkers. I shaped all the bunkers there, and you know, him just coming back repeatedly and being like, Tyler, massage that, make it look like it was always here, you know. And then we'd go behind it and look at it and make sure it didn't stick out. And that was like probably the first time that, because I did the bunkers at Dormey with Corn Crenshaw before that and worked on the greens with them. But this one, you know, those were a little more naturalistic and blown out. But these were kind of Walter Travis sunken pits. And it was pretty cool, you know, shaping those and working on that. So I'd say those guys were bunker artists. You know, they were genius. You know, all the Doak guys are so great about fitting things to the land and just seeing things. Green experience, all of that.
The very much McKenzie School of Art.
100%. Yep.
The camouflage.
Yeah, art of camouflage. Yep. And so, and then with Keith Foster, you know, he was great with committees. And I learned, you know, with him, it's like you have to get the work and you have to sell your product, and you have to, you know, he was a phenomenal he was really great about going against some of those. He would go up against Gil Hance or Tom Doak or any of those guys and win the job. And maybe his name wasn't as big as their name at the time, but he would go in there and he was really great describing his craft and then executing. He was phenomenal about, you know, doing a 4-month restoration, bringing it in on time, on budget, and with great results. Like his work at Brook Hollow, you know, in Texas is incredible. He worked at Colonial in Southern Hills before Gil, you know, Orchard Lake in Michigan, Moraine in, you know, in Philly Cricket. I mean, some of his work is phenomenal, you know, really, really first class. And so I watched him do cricket and Moraine from, you know, from when he was like hired, the day he was hired, all the way until it was finished. And it was just really eye-opening. He was a master. I mean, just a really, really great businessman and a great architect. And then finally with Ron Pritchard, you know, he showed me like the classical elegance and timelessness of beautiful design. And he always talked about, you know, work. He wanted his work to endure the test of time. So he was always saying, you know, Tyler, if it's good work, they won't come back in 10 years from now and redo it. You know, and so a lot of his work is still there. Like some of his work from the 90s, nobody has touched. You know, it's been 30 some years. And it's just like Jeffersonville is a great old Donald Ross course north of Philadelphia. He did the bunkers, I think, in 2000. So 24 years ago. And they're still, people still go there and they're like, wow, this is a great Donald Ross course. Like the bunkering is phenomenal.
Wow. So, there you come.
Yeah. So Ross, you know, and his proclivity and heritage and the way he honored Ross. I mean, he pretty much opened my eyes to Donald Ross because I didn't know anything about Donald Ross when I kind of started working with him about 12 or 13 years ago. And so, yeah, so that's the long-winded version of those four architects that I kind of studied under.
Well, on the Donald Ross stuff, we do need to get to approach it because I think it is very smart of you to choose someone who's probably built the most golf courses in America. As a man who specializes in restorations as well, it's not specializes, but you're quite well known now for your restorations. To choose an old architect who's built what 400 golf courses?
Yeah, 422, 423. I mean, every year there's like another add-on, but yeah, exactly.
And was that just a smart move by you, or did you just fall in love with Donald Ross?
It was serendipitous, you know, working with Ron Pritchard, and he was kind of like, they kind of call him Golf Architecture Magazine with Adam Lawrence and those gents. They wrote an article probably about 5 years ago on Ron Pritchard, and they called him the grandfather of restorations in America because he started restoring courses, I think, in 1988 before it was ever in vogue, you know, and looking at the old plans, trying to put back bunkers and that was when people were still just blowing through and ruining these old, beautiful golf courses. And so, and he did the first restoration at Aronimink in the mid 90s that, you know, mid 90s. And then I think early 2000s, like 2002, that really changed the game and really put restoration on the map. And so, you know, giving Ron deference, you know, the grandfather of restoration, or I guess it's the father of restoration.
Yeah.
But he opened my eyes to Ross and then, you know, I ran with it and, you know, luckily there's a couple other gentlemen who, you know, focus on Ross restorations and, or have done a handful and, but it's probably our bread and butter. Cause I think we've worked on about almost 50 now.
Oh God. Yeah. That's a lot.
Cause there's about 360 that are still around, you know, out of the 422 or 423 that he built, there's about 60 that have closed or sold off their land or, you know, their NLE no longer existing. So I think out of the 360, you know, we've almost worked on about 50.
So you've got about 310 to go, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We still have a ton to go. And we talk to Ross courses every day. I mean, every day.
Do they all call you, contact you?
Yeah, it's great. The Donald Ross Society is very kind to us. And then we doing the Wampanoag Country Club up in Connecticut, That was the home of the Donald Ross Society. And so having them pick us as the firm to kind of do their home course where the Ross Society started, that helps a lot.
Yeah, big time.
So people go there a lot and then they go, oh, well, who did the work here? Oh, Tyler. Oh, wow. This is great. You know? And, so that was a big nice feather in our cap, I guess. So.
On that note, obviously that gave you the standing in the Donald Ross Society, but how hard is it to go from being a shaper architect with someone else to doing your own job as Tyler Ray?
That's probably the hardest part, the transition, you know, having, you know, I would go into so many boardrooms and committee rooms and you could hear the guys go, who's Tyler Ray? Never heard of this guy. You know, who are we meeting today? You know? And so unfortunately, so many golfers in America and the UK, I mean, there's only probably two or three or four household names that you see in Golf Digest or, you know, in any publication that you see over there, Golf Monthly or, you know, Golf Week, Golf Magazine, you know, there's a couple publications, Golf Architecture. So you only see a couple names, and there's a couple international names. Everybody knows Tom Fazio and Martin Ebert and Mackenzie and Ebert, you know, and things Ebert's like that. Yep. And guys you've had on here you can go kind of anywhere and people know those names. But for us, you know, my name was so low on the totem pole, you know, I don't think anybody really had heard of us much. And so for us, the way we got work or the way we built our firm was, you know, I would visit 200-400 courses a year, knock on doors and just say, hey, you know, I just want to come see the golf course. And so it was great twofold. It was great because I wanted to see the course and study the architecture. And I wanted to see all the top 100 lists, all the lists, like your website, you know, that's so great. You know, I wanted to see everything that's great in America and everything that's great in the world. And so I would just write emails, cold call, write letters, drop in on guys, superintendents, pros, and no one had ever, you know, oh, great, you're an architect. Great. Where are you from? You know, oh, cool. What are you working on? And they would have no idea where I was working at the time, you know? And so, but then I would go out and walk the golf course and then come back in and just stop back in. And then I'd talk about their course. And that's where you would gain their kind of respect, because then I would talk about things on their course and they were like, oh, wow. Yeah. I've been playing here 30 years. I never thought about that. Or like, what were your top three holes that you liked? And I'd go boom, boom, boom. And I'd say, yeah, but these three holes probably are the weakest links. And they go, wow, that's exactly right. And so you would gain credibility. And then they would say, well, you know, maybe we'll give you a shout, you know, if we're ever going to do bunkers or if we're ever looking for a guy in the future. And then ironically, I mean, those clubs would call all the time, you know, 5-10 years later. And so from 2006 to 2020, you know, it was 14 or 15 years. I just visited every single course I could and slowly, you know, handed out my card and, hey, if you ever, you know, ever want to shoot the breeze or send me an email or, you know, if I'm back in the area, I'd love to stop back in. And so I created a lot of friendships that way and met a ton of golf pros who I still talk to all over and then tons of superintendents. You know, and then I'd see them on Twitter or something or Instagram and they'd say, hey, Tyler, you know, you stopped in last month, you know, thanks so much. That was such a cool, enlightening talk. Like we had so much fun, you know, you just coming out. And so it was sales when you really get down to the, you know, crux of it. That is marketing and sales. But for me, I just wanted to see their course. I mean, I couldn't tell you, James, there were probably, maybe I stopped at 2000, you know, the last 20 years, you know, and this is, I mean, in Australia, the whole British, all of British Isles, you know, everything, all the continental Europe. And some places I'd walk and I'd say, you know, I don't see myself ever doing anything here. Or you knock on the door and nobody was there at the end of the day. You know, the super was gone. The greenkeeper was gone for the day. The pro was gone. And so you'd say, oh, well, maybe I'll never see those guys again. But so there were so many that I never heard from and never kept in touch with. But when I saw a course that I really liked or that I thought, you know, that I fancied, or I thought was like, whoa, this thing could be really good, or this needs a restoration, or, you know, I love the area. You know, some places you go to and you're like, I just want to work in this area because it's such a beautiful area. Like around Swinley Forest or, you know, Sunnydale. Yeah. It's like, I love Ascot and that whole area. It's so beautiful. The courses, you know, are great too. I just want to work there. And so for me, if I really like the area and I really like the course and saw some potential, I would then follow up, you know, send an email a week later. Hey, you know, this is Tyler who popped in on Monday, you know, 10 days ago. I just wanted to say hi. And it's golf and it's a relationship driven industry. So of course they were saying, oh, thanks so much for stopping by. Nobody ever does that. You know, we never have guys just stop in. You know, that was so cool to shoot the breeze with you, Tyler. You know, that was so much fun. And so they would remember me. And then you'd be shocked, James, how many of those clubs, that's how I built my business. And so, you know, just relationships and putting in, you know, putting in the effort. You know, when you show effort like that, people are, they're appreciative because they say, wow, like you went out. You took time out of your day to come see my course that I love and that's so meaningful to me. You know, some of these superintendents were there 40 years. That's all they know. They know their family and their friends and their golf course.
Yeah.
And you're and I was coming to their pride and joy. And they couldn't wait to talk about it and show me it. You know, so many superintendents wanted to drive the golf course with me and pros. Yeah.
It's whenever someone shows interest in what you do, they're instantly. Yeah, I completely. That's an amazing technique and way of doing things. Because I've always described golf architecture in a way. It's like in terms of going out by yourself, unless you have something lined up, it's very similar to whiskey. In terms, it takes 3 years to produce whiskey, and it takes 3 years for a club to decide whether they're going to do the renovation. And as a business model, it kind of sounds mad, right? So
I like that. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And then think about it like, as a business, you can't just wait around for the phone to ring. I mean, it's never going to ring. And so, you know, you got to just take things into your own hands and chase it. If you really want it, you know, that's why life is so great. If you really want it, go after it, head over heels. You can't do anything wrong.
Yeah. Show interest and,
yeah. And be yourself, right? You know, be yourself, have a personality. You know, I would go in and shoot the breeze with these guys and just have fun and show your passion and talk about how great their course was, or, you know, talk about this and that. Guys love everybody, all of us. Look at us. We love discussing golf courses and holes and the merit of this hole versus this. And so, you know, they were always fun conversations and, you know, get these guys thinking a little bit. You know,
I would like one from the British Isles or Europe and one from America. Which golf course have you seen the most potential in that you don't think is utilized yet?
Wow. You know, that's a deep one. Probably in the UK. Gosh. One that I saw, you know, I mean, I remember Hunter Combe going there and being like, this thing, whew, you know, if the greens had trunked it a little bit, kind of over-treed, and the fairways have, you know, I felt like at its climax, Hunter Combe was probably really funkadelic and cool. So I loved that one, but it was a little tired and worn out.
That's the amazing thing about it. It still ranks very highly without that extra attention. So the members probably don't want to do anything because they see it as, oh, we're already ranked high. Why would we change it?
Right. You just and I don't want to change it at all. I just want to like clean up the bunkers a little bit, push out the fairways, cut down some trees, get the greens back. Some of the greens have just shrunken. You know, some of those greens have kind of moved in and the tees are a little beat up. And so it's just maybe a little nip and tuck, just, but not a heavy hand, no bulldozer action type thing.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, there are probably a handful over there in the UK that I thought were so, so sneaky. You know, West Sussex always stuck with me. I didn't really want to change much there either, but I just thought the bones were so good and it wasn't really talked about enough. You know, I thought that one could be in the top 2030 conversation, you know, for the UK. And maybe it is up there by now, but I saw that in 2009. I remember being like, I could join this place tomorrow. I loved West Sussex. You know, Brancaster, you know, that one.
Oh, don't get me started about that place.
That is just
one of my favorite in the world.
Just divine, you know. And then when I was at, I remember at Woking, I went around there a couple of times. Richard Pennell was there. Or he might have been in New Zealand when I was there. He was at New Zealand. Then I think he got the job as the secretary at Woking. But we played a couple games at Woking, and they were just starting to cut down some trees. And because, I mean, you could hit golf balls out there, and it was very tight in areas. And I think they finally, after 2009, they went out and cleaned up some things and opened it up a little bit.
Is it the famous centerline bunker?
Yeah, that hole was mind-boggling because being the stupid American, I just beat it down the left side of and then I was completely stymied because then I hit a wedge and it hit the backside of the bunker, went all the way off the back of the green, and then I three-putted. And then I think Richard hit it down the right, the train tracks, and then played a beautiful little shot in to about 3 feet and made birdie.
Do you want to know an interesting fact? You might already know this, but there's a higher percentage of Scottish people who are a member of Woking than English people. There is over 50% Scottish members, which is a hilarious fact for a London golf club.
Yeah, that is wild. Huh.
There's so many people move down there because it's the big city, you know, it's like people moving to New York or California.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
And how about in the States? Is there any golf courses that you want to?
Yeah, I mean, there's Deepdale. You know, I think Deepdale is like the furthest from the Seth Rayner, CB McDonald kind of ethos and roots. When there was there's a highway right there. I can't remember the number of the highway, but it kind of lopped off a little bit of their land. I think the Long Island Expressway, I think that's what it is, the LIE. The land and, I mean, Deepdale was one of the best back in the day. And then probably, I know you only asked for one, but it's hard for me to.
No, I'm more than one's perfect. I'd rather have a number.
Yeah, a couple others. You know, I think, Deepdale was always one that stuck out to me. And then probably there's a course in Nashville called Belmead. That was an old Donald Ross course that, Belmead Country Club, that I've kind of been looking at and stopping in and saying hi and doing my thing, you know. But it's a beautiful course, and I think, you know, it's probably should be the best in Nashville, in Nashville, Tennessee. And it just, you know, I think it could really, you know, use a little bit of work in the future and could be very stunning. I think the Ross plans are really cool for that one. So.
Well, that's very cool. I find it such an interesting discussion because it's understanding the bones of a golf course and the ground that you have, being able to play with. And then for someone like an architect who's able to visualize exactly how they would change things or alter or tidy up or do whatever that is needing to be done, and then knowing already that it's going to be a better golf course because you just understand at that higher level, it's an interesting, very, very impressive skill. There's a question I've noticed that I forgot to ask you earlier. How difficult is it when a golf course comes to you and asks about budget on renovation or a design? I don't know, a redesign of a few holes. How difficult is it to negotiate on budget? Do they come to you with, this is our budget, can you do the job? And then you say yes or no? Or do people normally know that it costs quite a lot to do these things?
Yeah, the budget, they usually have a budget in their mind. And I always say, let us shoot for the stars. And, you know, say we're hired, usually it takes about 3 to 6 months to create a master plan or a property plan for the future that's going to set themselves up for success. And it's kind of usually a 15, 20 year plan. But you try to accomplish all those goals a little quicker than that, obviously. But some things take longer, like trees, you know, either plantings or removals, and then native grasses and peripheral stuff, screening houses, things of that nature, screening the property boundary. But usually they hire you and they have a number in their head that they can digest, you know, that they think their members can digest. You know, they don't want to spend $20 million. They don't want to spend, you know, but they know they can spend more than 2 to 3. So in America, we're very fortunate where a lot of these clubs are just so full and they have long, long wait lists and they have, you know, the funding. Whereas I know in the UK, I mean, they're smaller projects. It's so much more economical to join those courses in the UK, you know, a couple hundred quid a year instead of, you know, 15 or 20,000. In America, we've unfortunately, the divide, it's kind of grotesque and depressing that it is such a expensive game in America, and wet game. You know, it's a slog in America, Parkland golf. Whereas the beauty of golf, you know, growing up, seeing the British Isles, you know, where you can go play all winter on the firm turf, you know, the sandy soil, and it drains well. And, you know, bring your little buggy or trolley, you know, you bring your little pool cart.
A lot of the time I just take 7 clubs, just go out and enjoy myself.
And I do that in the winter here. I'll play odds one round and then evens the next round. And so I always bring a half bag with a little ping moonlight bag with a little half set. My father does the same thing, but, and I'm going to do that Sunday. I'm going to play 9 holes in my club, Bitterman, with just half set. But I think, you know, the golf courses in the UK being so economical, unfortunately, it lends themselves to having smaller budgets, and your projects over there aren't really massive, but they don't need to be. You know, the courses are so great, they don't need a heavy hand. Where in America, sometimes in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, somebody had a heavy hand and they spent too much money and they dug a big lake here on this hole and then they did this and then they planted all these trees here and then they rerouted the course or blew up all the old Ross greens. And so we, fortunately, I guess it would be for a businessman like us, we're fortunate that there are a lot more courses in America that were heavily touched and altered. And now we've gotten to refine them and we have bigger budgets. So I know speaking with Martin Ebert, you know, sometimes he laments the fact that he works in the UK where it might be, he might get called from a club and it's one bunker, you know, or it's one green. And where we get calls and it's like, hey, we want you to reroute the golf course to what it used to be. And you're going to rebuild every green, every fairway. You're going to do this. You're going to fill in ponds and it's going to be $9 million, you know? And so Martin's like, that's a beautiful job. You know, that would be a lot of fun for us. And where he doesn't get that so much. So we get those calls every day, not every day, but we get them more frequently. And, you know, so
I guess that's why Martin went off and did more and has done a bit in Asia and done a bit more overseas.
Yeah. But I know he's working, I think, at like Country Club of Bogota down in South America and some other things like that, the Caribbean and things of that nature, because that's where the fun stuff is and that gets his blood pumping, you know. And but at the same time, I would love to work on some of his courses, you know, that he's worked on, like Port Rush. I mean, gosh, yeah. I'd probably cut off a finger, you know, to work there, you know, and, you know, some of those beautiful courses, because I actually really love those jobs where it's just minor refinements and you can make the golf course better with little changes here or there. You know, the big jobs are very stressful and there's a lot of pressure, you know, from memberships, you know, putting the weight on your shoulders, like, oh, Tyler, you better really, this better turn out as good as you say it is, you know. It's you know,
it's a lot of money.
The members at Lookout Mountain, you know, it's like the lifeblood of that club. It was depending on us, and we rebuilt 20 greens and all the bunkers and all the tees, and I mean, so heavy-handed. It's just, it better come out great. So
well, you have done a brilliant job. I think we've probably been on, we've been on for an hour, so we should probably start to wrap things up, as much as I've got a few more questions. Mm-hmm. I always finish the last question, same question for everyone. It's top five favorite golf courses, the ones that mean the most to you.
Yeah. I think, the Old Course has to be right there at the start. I've had some magical rounds out there, and I don't love, Raiders all the time put too much emphasis on how they played. So I don't want to start off saying that, I played so well there. It's meaningful, but it is like spiritual when I go there. And I've played there. I've been fortunate to play there a lot. We would go over the UK every other year, every odd year. And I've been there with a bunch of my father. And but yeah, it's just, you see something different every time you're there, and the greens are so big and they have so much stuff going on. And then there's other greens that are pretty flat, when you get out there, 8, 9, 10, stuff like that. So it has such great variety. And when the wind is blowing in different directions, it plays differently. And I've played there in a fog where you don't see anything really, and you just hit it off the tee and you're like, well, I hope I don't find some of those bunkers or hell bunker or any of that stuff, Strat.
Just fingers crossed it's gone left.
Right. Exactly. And so that is spiritual, and I always look forward to that immensely. Probably Pine Valley, is right there. I'm fortunate to live 42 minutes from there. And so I play there a lot, and there's no poor holes. There's no weak links. And so it's the closest thing to perfection. I'd say Cypress Point is right there, but the 18th, I get so disappointed when I play the 18th at Cypress Point. The green is almost unputtable. It's such a funky dog leg. There's the trees have grown in and they overhang so much where it's almost a weird, it's just a funky 18th. But the first 17 holes would give Pine Valley and Royal Melbourne, the composite there. I think those three are like the best. And Shinnecock as well, right there. But so I'd go Old Course, and then Pine Valley, Shinnecock. Shinnecock would be the prettiest, probably, because when you're out there, it's just so gorgeous, and the wind's blowing. And I was up there in October, and I brought my three best buddies, and it was their first time playing, and it was just like another spiritual day, and it's so good and vexing. You have great holes where you make a birdie and the next hole you make a triple. and you like almost hit the green in regulation, but then it goes off. Like the Redan there, I hit it on the green. It rolled all the way off the green into the bunker. Then I hit it out of the bunker to about 2 feet, and the wind blew it off the green down to my feet in the bunker again. And I was like, I look at the caddy and he goes, play it out over here. So then I hit it on to the back part of the green and 3-putt. So I just made birdie, and then I hit a really good shot to probably about 10 feet from the tee, and it goes in the bunker, and it was almost unplayable. And he's like, yeah, it's Shinnecock, when the wind gets blowing and these greens get crisp. But it was like, how diabolical is that? A lot of fun. So
it's evil.
Yeah, those three, Swinley Forest, probably yeah. Right there, number four, because that's just divine. And I know it's a more stuffy club or a tougher club to go play. And I don't ever care about the club dynamics or how much money it costs or any of that. I don't care about that at all. It's just when you pull in those gates, the golf is incredible. The clubhouse is gorgeous. They treated me. I went there multiple times in the past and they've been so kind to me. And it's like, that par under par 68, it's not regulation kind of that feel. I love that.
They just put whatever the best thing they could in the property they had.
Yes.
It didn't matter about what par or how it flowed. It flows better because of it.
Exactly. And you don't think about it when you're out there. I never think about par. I could care less about par. It doesn't matter. It's just a number. That is divine to me. And Harry Colt's probably my favorite. I think he's the best.
Do you?
Yeah, I think Colt, if you look at his top 20 and, Colt, then McKenzie, Ross Flynn, Mike Stranz, those five are kind of my guys. I think Rainer's CB McDonald, Rainer or somewhere around there. But Colt, you think of Rye, you think of Sunningdale New. I like Sunningdale New more than old, and then you think of Swinley and you think of, Port Rush, Those greens have so much character. They have more character than 95% of other courses in the British Isles. You know, all the little wrinkles and everything in Fort Rush.
The thing that I would say about Colt that I is my argument for why he is so good is the fact that Muirfield is probably the worst bit of land with the best per golf, like the highest ranked golf course with the worst for the worst bit of land. Does that make sense?
100%. Yeah. I think it's my favorite in all the UK. You know, that and then Turnberry are my top two, and then Dornoch right there in the old course. But I think, you know, Muirfield is I played 308 courses or saw 308. Because I've marked them all down in the UK in my life, and Muirfield's the best. And that it's routing,
my favorite.
You know, the outer loop, inner loop, and then the greens, how much character they have. I mean, everything about it, and then the experience, obviously. But if you look at his body of work, I mean, Colt is just. And I remember working for Keith Foster, you know, 06 to 08, 09, and I remember him saying that. Then, and I didn't really know much. I didn't make my first trip to UK until early 09. And then I understood why he said Harry Colt was the best, because he used to say that. And I was like, Harry Colt? I was like, what about McKenzie? What about Ross? What about Flynn? You know? And he was like, Colt, you know? And so when I hear other architects and when they say, yeah, Colt's the best, then you're like, they get it. They know. They've seen a lot, you know? And then probably the final will be Royal Melbourne. Yeah, that composite course.
Definitely the composite, not the West alone or the East alone.
I mean, the West is great, but there's a couple of those like four or five holes from the East just make it so much better.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you, Tyler, for coming on. That was an absolute joy speaking to you and hearing about your process and how the difficulties and also the fortunes that have come with your career. It's been fascinating.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Thanks, James, for having me. And I know I was long-winded on...
No, not at all.
I could talk for days on a lot of these beautiful subjects, and I love it. I love it so much. I love golf so much. I love architecture so much. It's easy sometimes for me to just ramble.
Tyler, thank you very much for a wonderful interview and an incredible insight on what it's like to climb the ranks over the 2008 kind of crash, and just a brilliant interview. And your worldview of golf is fascinating. If anyone wants to get in touch, it's james@top100golfcourses.com or on the Instagram @officialtop100. Thank you very much for listening, and remember to play fast, lunch slow.